from the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, out of the office today, so no update of the commodity markets from the CME Group in Chicago. We'll call this program A Different Path because we plan to explore several different paths. We'll start out by discussing a FarmDoc Daily article with Carl Zuloff. He's from the Ohio State University, where he's an emeritus professor of agricultural economics, and has written on the different path that took place over the last several decades as U.S. farmers expected to export more of their crops, and frankly, the rest of the world picked up the slack as their middle classes developed. And then we'll turn our attention to renewable diesel here in the United States. We've been talking about this since late last fall, and the potential impact it could have on the soybean market over the long run, and a new market development for soybeans domestically in the United States. I spoke earlier in the year about this with University of Illinois agricultural economist Scott Irwin. I thought it would be worthwhile listening to that interview again because there's a different path there as well. And as we wrap up our discussions for the day, we'll turn our attention to conservation and a different path that could take place as it's related to carbon sequestration. We'll hear more from Ruth McCabe. She's a conservation agronomist with Heartland Co-op in Iowa. And it all happens on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Don't forget, you can find our program anytime you'd like to listen to on demand at willag.org, willag.org, and you'll find a way to listen to us as a podcast as well there. Links to places like Stitcher, SoundCloud, NPR One, Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast too. Now, let's begin our discussion for the day, A Different Path. I started with Carl Zuloff in an article he's written on kind of the history of how we've gotten here in agriculture.
Okay. Carl Zuloff, emeritus professor, Ohio State University.
You have written an article for the FarmDoc Daily website, taking a look back over the prosperity of agriculture across the planet over the last several decades, and compared that to what's been happening in the United States. Can you tell me about it?
The big difference is that the story in the U.S. is that basically we had an era of farm prosperity that began 2006, 2007, continued through 2013, and then there has been a much more normal period of time, or even a struggle in some people's views since then. If you look at the world agriculture, and we don't have the same kind of measurements, so you've got to look at indirect indicators, such as acres harvested, et cetera. What I find, and in the article tells the story, that prosperity really has continued after 2013 in the rest of the world. The United States struggles with financial returns is more of the exception than the norm for the rest of the world.
Are there reasons for that inside the U.S. or outside of the United States?
The article postulates that the primary reason is a difference in the use and the rate of growth of consumption. That would certainly not be the only factor, Todd, but that would be a critical factor, because we know that prosperity depends upon a fairly sustained high relative rate of growth in use. And in particular, what the article reports on is the very rapid growth since 2000 in feed grain use in the rest of the world. Just compared with respect to the U.S. and just simply compared with respect to itself, if you look over time from 1980 to 2000, the average annual increase in feed grain use around the rest of the world was 4.4 million metric tons. That increased to 16.7 million metric tons in the first decade of this century. So that was a little bit less than a 4x increase. And then it almost doubled again to 30 million metric tons in 2010, 2020. So there's been a big increase in the rate of growth of feed grain use. Most economists would suggest that that is probably the result of increased meat consumption as countries have moved higher up on the per capita income scale and consume more meat. But the growth in feed grain is quite stark, quite large around the world outside the U.S. over in this particular decade. And I think that's the primary reason.
So the thought at one point was that producers in the United States would be able to export to these areas of the world where red meat consumption was clearly about to begin to grow because the wealth in those areas was coming on. There was a larger middle class that was developing. But really what has happened is that local agriculture, domestic agriculture in those areas has grown more than what the United States might have expected.
That is correct. There has been in the U.S., land area in agriculture has really changed very little since the really going all the way back to the early 1970s, Todd. We haven't seen much of a change in principal crop acres. We haven't seen much of a change in total field crop acres, no matter how you really cut it at the aggregate level. Now, we have seen an increase in soybean acres, but not necessarily in field crop acres over that period of time. In the rest of the world since 2000, we have seen acres increase by almost 18 million acres per year. That is a pretty big increase. And we know from economics that acres won't increase unless there's an incentive to expand production because you have to pay for bringing the land in. So there has been a real incentive to expand output in the rest of the world. And that output has largely met the increased consumption that's coming from a variety of different sources, but principally probably from meat.
So the mantra that they're not making any more land, while true, doesn't mean that more land can't come into production.
Absolutely. The U.S. has a constrained land base when it comes to agriculture for a variety of reasons, policy reasons, and probably economic reasons also. The rest of the world does not have that. And in addition, I would note, Todd, that there's the issue of double cropping that particularly with respect to Brazil has been a major driver. So all of this is not necessarily more acres in a sense of more acres with an individual crop, but you may be cropping intensively, double cropping, even triple cropping in some areas, and that actually increases the acres harvested because each crop for a year is counted as a harvested acre. And we do the same thing in the U.S. with respect to double cropping of soybeans.
Carl Zuloff is a professor emeritus of agricultural economics for The Ohio State University. You may find the article we've been discussing on the Farm Doc Daily website. It's entitled Ongoing World Crop Prosperity and U.S. Crop Agriculture. You're listening to a special edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. We call this one A Different Path. We've discussed a different path that happened across the planet in the last several decades as farmers in the United States were expecting to pick up a larger proportion of the export market. Actually, what happened was the development of agricultural production in other nations. In the same space, the United States was focusing on biofuels like ethanol. And now the next step may be in place. It's called renewable diesel. I took that up with Scott Herwin.
But it sure looks like we're going to add at least 2 billion gallons of renewable diesel capacity in the next 2 to 3 years. which is a giant amount of feedstock. But here's what people are missing, and this is the big question. How much of what we can now, what I would now call FAME biodiesel, which is the fatty acid methyl ester traditional biodiesel, is this going to cannibalize? That's the big question, the big unknown. Because renewable diesel is a little bit more favorable for under the RFS, but not one. And instead of 1.5, it gets 1.6 or 1.7 RINs. But the real big thing is renewable diesel, it gets much higher carbon credits in California. And so renewable diesel will definitely cannibalize quite a bit of the FAME biodiesel market. We just don't know how much. Goldman Sachs says that we'll never produce another gallon more FAME biodiesel than we are today. It's really a very, it's got some stark implications for the distribution of what we call biodiesel in the U.S.
Right, and it vertically integrates renewable diesel directly into the oil industry's supply chain?
Yep. Although that's not strictly true.
But is the idea that soybean is going to be the primary feedstock? For this because of the ease of availability for it? Or is there, what about corn oil or any other oil? Because it can all be used, right?
Well, that's the real issue going forward. Is that's why, Goldman's analysis is that not all these renewable diesel plants will get built because there just isn't enough feedstock to make them economically feasible without blowing out global fat and oil prices. Because it's interesting, what I've learned, like I said, I've really been digging in on the details of it, I just haven't written much, is that renewable diesel actually uses, and this makes total sense once you understand the production process, a bit more feedstock than FAME biodiesel does. Because they have to heat it up and it's under pressure, it's a little less efficient use of the feedstock. So it takes about 7.8 pounds of feedstock to make a gallon of renewable diesel, where it's about 7.5 pounds for FAME biodiesel. But it is definitely a big deal. It is the next version of the biofuels boom. It's definitely coming. It's already being felt in world vegetable oil markets. But there's a lot of uncertainty about predicting its impacts moving forward. Number one, how many of the plants on the in the planning stage are ever going to break ground and be built? And then number two, if they do get built, what kind of pressure will they put on feedstock prices, and how much of traditional FAME biodiesel demand will they cannibalize? Those are the big questions.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to give us some answers.
Well, that's on the planning stage. We've got a few more things I'm going to write about. But you're right. It's a big story, and but the real interesting part of it is it's being driven not by the RFS, it's being driven by the LCFS.
The low carbon
fuel standard in California.
So I've been covering it, on and off for a while. And then Reuters broke the story put out that story that USDA was going to add a line to the soybean S&D table for it.
Well, there's more going on than that. The EIA has never separated out renewable diesel production from FAME biodiesel production, and they're going to start doing that.
Jumping in here, in fact, that change was made for the very first time in the WASD, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate Tables, this month, the month of May. Now, let's continue with Scott Irwin and our discussion about renewable diesel. This was recorded earlier in the year.
But it'll be interesting. You can actually measure it pretty well now based on RINs. The RINs distinguish between the different classifications. And so that's how people, that's how I have estimated it. I have actually estimated all this with, if you'll look at all my biodiesel supply articles on Farm Doc Daily, I have different lines for FAME. I don't call it FAME, but it's different categories of D4 RINs are the 1.6 and 1.7s are renewable diesel.
What is FAME? Is that an acronym?
Well, right. It's not used a lot. It's used a lot in Europe. FAME biodiesel is fatty acid methyl ester. That's the process used like at the Cargill biodiesel plant up in Gibson City.
Yeah.
That's how you make what we think of as biodiesel. You just take veg oil or fats and oils and you add a catalyst to it. You got to get the water and glycerin out of it. And you've got what we call biodiesel. But as we know, biodiesel is not a drop-in fuel. You can't use, you just can't fill up a diesel engine with 100% FAME biodiesel and it won't work. It'll gum up. So that's why you have typically low blends of 2 to 5, maybe up to 20%. But that's what we think of as biodiesel. Really should technically now, to keep things straight, that's why you see in my writings, Todd, I now always use the terms FAME biodiesel and renewable diesel. And because they're completely different products. And then in the RFS, both of those come under the heading of biomass-based diesel. So those are the three terms. Biomass-based diesel is the umbrella category. So both FAME biodiesel and renewable diesel are eligible to for compliance with the biomass-based diesel mandate. There's actually no biodiesel mandate in the RFS. It's called biomass-based diesel so that it can accommodate FAME biodiesel and renewable diesel.
Everybody needs to understand what this product is.
Yes, because it is going to be a big deal. There is no doubt about that. But there's some real large uncertainties about exactly where it's going to go. And I always tell people, I'm always interested in what's the impact on corn and soybean farmers, you know, on corn and soybean prices. And it's not as easy as ethanol was.
That was Scott Irwin, recorded earlier in the year discussing renewable diesel. You can watch the Farm Doc Daily website for articles on renewable diesel as he produces them over the coming months. That at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. Now let's continue down a different path in agriculture for the United States. Under the Biden administration, it sure appears that carbon sequestration will become a big part of what farmers are likely to do over the next several decades. The question, though, really is how that will happen. Ruth McCabe has been thinking about that. She's a conservation agronomist at Heartland Co-op in Iowa. I talked to her earlier in the year as well. We were talking about perennial grasses and the potential for the marketplace for them, bedding, other sorts of things. But I asked if they really needed to be harvested.
I mean, sure, if you signed up for CRP, right? Like, if you're going to be putting in a CRP prairie, you don't have to harvest those. You know, and that's actually, it's actively discouraged to harvest unless there's like an emergency forage order that's put down for something like CRP. And hey, bonus, the USDA just announced all of these new CRP rules. Very exciting. They're going to increase the payments and they're going to open up more acre qualifications. And they're even looking at things like potentially, you know, calculating things like carbon sequestration and a bunch of other really interesting things. So I'm going to be encouraging the growers that I work with to reconsider CRP as an option to answer your question.
4 million acres available.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that, to be clear, like that is an option, you know, that is an option to grow perennial grasses, especially if you're not going to harvest them. But for people who are considering perennial grasses for harvesting in some capacity, there is a market. I think right now it's limited, but I think that it has potential to really grow. And I, you know, I work with growers that want to get into growing perennial grasses to harvest them. I've got growers right now that have asked me about this. And, you know, usually my answer is, it's like, well, there is a market, but it's small. And you have to be aggressive about going after it. You know, I mean, you've got to market yourself. You've got to find a local, sometimes you have to build it yourself. You got to find somebody that maybe wants to buy bedding from you. You have to find somebody that needs, that wants to get into biomass, you know, biofuels, or wants to purchase, you know, biomass for co-firing with coal. You've got to seek out those relationships. Sometimes not all growers are necessarily interested in that level of work that it's going to be required to build their own, you know, market. I do think that there's great potential for perennial biomass in the future. I just think that if you look at it like a, almost like a chemistry equation, right? Like, we're still building the activation energy, and we haven't quite gotten to that point on the graph where the reaction goes from being endothermic to exothermic and releasing energy and taken off on its own. I just think we're in a stage where people are still building interest. Industry is still gaining interest. You know, with all this, with all these carbon market options, which that is another ball of wax entirely, but with all these carbon market options, there's a lot of companies, large companies, food companies, beverage companies, et cetera, that are coming to the table and saying, okay, we really want to get in on this. How can we diversify our streams? You know, how can we diversify the growers' operations? How can we make this better? How can we make it more, quote unquote, sustainable? And I think that a part of that equation, I think that part of that solution is going to be perennial grasses for biomass, especially coming on board. Carbon is, I think, really driving a lot of those conversations right now.
And to be clear, that'll probably be for an offset, correct?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. A lot of these companies, and a lot of, you know, these large food and beverage companies, will say, for the sake of anonymity, are really asking that exact question. Like, well, how can we offset the carbon that we're releasing?
They don't have to be anonymous. They're PepsiCo and Coca-Cola, we know for sure. Probably other large,
and a few others,
other large companies too. I've talked to them on the air already more than once. So they're clearly in the hunt for ways to offset their energy use with carbon credits of some sort.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
That was Ruth McCabe. There's more, of course, to talk about as it's related to carbon sequestration and how that marketplace might yet develop in the United States. The Biden administration at this point is asking producers, landowners, and other interested parties what they think about carbon sequestration and the best ways to go about making that a marketplace. I suspect we'll hear very soon what they have come up with. You've been listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report. This one's a special edition, A Different Path. I'm Todd Gleason.